This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When Sue Etheridge was in school to become an art therapist, one of her instructors advised her to work with those she loved. She didn't know it at the time, but she would come to love thousands of mentally ill inmates at the federal prison in Butner, North Carolina. She has guided prison patients to create their own paintings and drawings for 24 years. And she was recently recognized by the Dalai Lama for her efforts. Sue Etheridge joins us today on The State of Things. Welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Did you always want to be an art therapist or an artist? What was your initial attraction, I guess, to the arts?
Well, actually, I grew up with art materials in the house my whole childhood. It wasn't until I returned to college the second time that I got a degree in commercial art in my undergraduate studies. And I worked in industry as a designer for several years, but I was also taking a pastoral counseling degree in graduate school. When I heard about the field of art therapy, I discontinued that graduate degree and went and got a master's degree in art therapy as a specialty.
Well, let's find out what drew you away from college the other time. Where were you headed on those other starts?
I became a mom. Uh-huh. I got married and had little children at the time, so discontinued my college work for a while. And when I went back, I knew that I wanted to study art.
And you have a military background, right?
Yes,
Dad was
I do.
In the military?
My father was in military. He was a radar navigator on a B-52.
Wow. And so I understand that you knew the stars and your alphabet roughly the same time.
The same time. That's right.
That's pretty good. And tell us about all these art materials at home, because your mother was an accomplished seamstress, at
yes.
least for the family, right?
Yes, my mother, there were three girls in the family, and she sewed everything we wore. We could get our 17 magazine and show her a picture, and she could replicate whatever we wanted to wear.
That is the height of creativity, isn't it?
It really is.
Because she would, take whatever material is available or know where to get the material.
Right.
And turn it into whatever was in your imagination.
That's right. That's right. She was very gifted in that way.
At the time when you were plowing through 17 magazine looking for things to wear, were you aware of the fact that this was kind of a sort of a genius that your mother exhibited?
Probably not to the extent that it really was. I mean, we were teenagers after all.
That's what I gave you that out. When did it occur to you that this is kind of a real creative art, that this ability is?
Well, my sisters and I actually did take a sewing class when we were kids. Mm. And so we learned the creativity of that early on. And it was so frustrating because we'd sew a seam at our class and come home and mother would have us rip it out and redo it and then take it back to class and the teacher would have us rip it out and redo it again.
So, little conflict in artistic vision
yes,
there.
That's right.
I understand it. Yeah. So you said you were going to seminary, right? You
went yes.
to, well, tell us about that. What attracted you to that?
My husband was a pastor of a Baptist church. So he was in seminary and got his degree at Southeastern in Louisville. And then we moved here to North Carolina, which is his home state. And eventually I enrolled at Southeastern Seminary in Wake Forest. And that was in the 80s. That's mm-hmm. ancient history.
But something. So then you left. What was it then about art therapy that made you think that this was for you?
Because I understood the therapeutic value of art in my own life and in the art that I myself was doing.
Was there anything in the, because you mentioned that what appealed to you about the ministry or that you were studying counseling
yes.
in the ministry. So had this been on your mind, the idea that you could somehow or another help people who are struggling with?
Well, I suppose so. I can remember being a hospice volunteer through our church and sitting with a hospice patient who was very still and asleep and a very good model for me to do drawings. And it was a healthful thing for me to be doing at the time. And I had an understanding and appreciation for that.
So you did get through school. You became an art therapist. And it's interesting because tell us about going for your first job.
Well, I actually was out of a job, looking for a job. And in those days, you would look in the classifieds in the paper.
Oh, I remember those.
Yes. So there were two job openings, one for teaching English as a second language to Spanish-speaking people, and the other for teaching art. And they were half-time positions, and I thought, I could do either or both of those, and they had the same phone number in the classified ad.
That's great.
So I found out it was Durham Tech, and they had an extension at the federal prison. So that's where I went to interview in the education department. But in that interview, I said, what I would really like to do is be an art therapist. And they said, oh, you need to go speak to them in the psychiatric hospital. They had just been audited by the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation and had been critiqued for not having enough rehab therapies. And in I walked, wanting an internship.
Now, was this at Butner?
At Butner, yes. And after my internship, they hired me, and I stayed 24 years.
Wow. So tell us about that. What's the environment there? What did you walk into? Because you had not, I mean, had you imagined up until that point doing art therapy at a prison hospital?
Not at all. I had never seen a psychiatric patient, and I had never seen an inmate. And in I walked, green as grass. But it's a beautiful place. Now it's a very large prison complex. But at that time, there was only one facility there, and it's what they call the FCI medium. And it was built as an experiment in corrections. It's a beautiful campus. It has the community green, and different services are located in a central location around the community green. And from that place, you could not see the fence at all. It has changed a lot and over the years, but that's how it was at that time.
So here's this experiment. They're thinking about corrections, about creating an environment for corrections, and yet the audit showed not enough in terms of art therapy, or was that was the deficiency?
Right.
So what did that mean when you got there? It means that they weren't at it.
Right.
And then you show up. Were they skeptical, or did they really welcome you?
I was very, very welcomed there. My supervisor is a renowned forensic psychiatrist, and I feel like I owe her my career. She was very welcoming, and so were the staff in general. We had recreation therapists at the time, but that was the only other rehab therapy that they had.
So was it, I have to ask you if you were apprehensive about this.
Well, I was. It's funny because when the inmates were out and walking around the prison, I felt very at ease. It was when they were locked down and the place looked like a ghost town that I would get the creeps. But I was all right. As a rule, I was all right.
And what kind of patients were you working with? Was it just the psychiatric? Because it's a large complex, right? So it's people with... people treated for medical as well as psychiatric illness, right?
Yes. Well, now it is. At that time, it was mostly the psychiatric patients. There were actually pretty well three classifications of psychiatric patients. There were some there for pretrial forensic evaluations to answer questions that go back to federal court on a person's competence to stand trial and their responsibility at the time of the offense. And there were patients who were in need of psychiatric treatment while they were incarcerated. And then there were some who were involuntarily committed due to dangerousness.
It's interesting to think about people in a psychiatric hospital within a prison. I mean, those confined to a hospital are indeed confined, and, yes. and particularly if they're a danger, whether they've been convicted of a crime. Is it different working in that environment for you as an art therapist, for someone who's going to try to bring out the creativity in these folks, working within the sort of double confinement of the prison and the hospital?
It's all I've known. So I guess you could say it's easy for me because I haven't had very much contrast from that. But I find the inmates respond beautifully to being given multisensory art materials that they can use in a place of very low stimulation.
We'll talk about those materials and the products that the inmates produced. Under the supervision of Sue Etheridge, an art therapist who works with inmates now in the state of North Carolina, but for 24 years at the federal prison in Butner. And our conversation on the state of things will continue from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Sue Etheridge, an art therapist who works with inmates now in the state of North Carolina. We're also talking about her 24-year career at the federal prison in Butner as an art therapist. And you were talking about those first days there. What were some of the strategies you used to try to make contact and to build trust?
Well, I think it's the magic of the art materials themselves. I come in, I'm the good mother. I have good gifts for them. And that automatically builds some rapport. And inmates don't have a lot of decisions to make all day, but on that page, they have freedom. And they respond very well to that.
How do you decide on the projects? Are you working one-on-one or in groups?
Most of my work has been in groups. I am trained in a couple of art therapy assessment tools. So it depends. That would be a one-on-one session to do an assessment. But most of the day-to-day work is in groups. And I can give you an example of a group that I would have, such as a themes group, where the participants come into the room and they're talking about whatever is on their mind. It might be what's going to be for lunch. It might be who had a visit this week. It could be anything. It could be something about home. Could be anything. But eventually a theme would emerge from the conversation in the group. And then I would ask them to do artwork around a theme.
That's interesting because that, it seems to me, requires some deep listening on your part.
Well, yes. I am a therapist. I'm an artist and a therapist and corrections. So that is kind of a layered on hybrid.
But it's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, people are talking about all kinds of things, right? Somebody says, I'm going to get a visit today from somebody I don't like, and that's kind of a sour note. Somebody else notices that it's raining. There are all these disparate things, and you're going to come up with one theme. It could lead to some conflict, and yet you've found a way, have you, to navigate this and find the consensus, find where there was a theme and seemingly disparate details?
The theme might be disparate details.
Aha. There, you are going to be a producer on the State of Things if you keep that up. That's how we do our show. Yeah, that's what's well done. So what about the project? Are there people who feel left out who say no? I don't want to participate. What do you do about that?
Well, they mostly are self referrals. The inmates who want to be there come to the group, and they aren't really often required unless their doctor requests that.
One of the things, I guess, that binds everybody is their schedule, and you found that calendars is a good way to start. Tell us about the calendar project.
Well, I had the tradition. I developed for myself the tradition of Xeroxing calendars at the beginning of every month, and I would walk around the housing units and give people calendars. You understand, in a prison, people don't necessarily have a calendar, and there's no way to get one. And yet when a psychologist is going or a nurse interviews a patient, the first thing they ask is, what's your name, what's the date, and where are you? That's being oriented times three. So if you don't have a calendar, you're kind of stuck. So anyway, I developed my own tradition of giving away calendars. So everybody knew me, and I had given them a gift.
Are these just sort of calendars from the outside, or is it the prison calendar with the daily schedule?
It's not a prison calendar. It just had the dates so that people could put their own schedules onto them.
But see that, I mean, just thinking about that small small detail and the sense of autonomy that you must have given someone to say, here is time, and you have some autonomy over these squares, at least to fill them in.
Right. They're doing time.
They're doing time.
When you think about it. And there are some inmates who would refuse. They would rather not keep track of time.
Sure.
If they have a long sentence, of course, they don't get a calendar if they don't want one.
Now, was there at any time your what kind of situation are you in? Do you ever have a sense of danger? These are people who are sometimes a threat to themselves. They can be unpredictable. Did you feel at risk at any time?
I won't say that I never felt at risk. It was rare for me to feel at risk. My groups would go on. I was wearing a radio, so I could get help immediately. It was a rare thing for me to need something like that.
There was one episode, I know, at least one, where a patient became aggressive. And
right.
This turned into an interesting story for you. Tell us about it.
Well, I had a group of really impaired psychiatric patients, very low functioning. And one of those patients came into the group, and he was talking about his belief that I was torturing Helen Keller. And he came into the group. There were about probably six people around a conference table in the group. And this patient could not let go of that thought. And he was going on and on. The other patients were getting scared. And so eventually he said something like, if so-and-so happens, I would kill somebody. And he said, and I do it too because I have killed over 200 rapists. What do you think of that? And I said, I think it's not a good idea to be talking about killing. And he lunged at me across the table and said, so you want to be raped? And I said, there's so much tension in the room today that I don't think we can have art therapy. And so I disbanded the group, and I had the officers come and take him to a locked cell. And he was there for a while until they adjusted his medication, and he was stabilized again. And he had a talk with me and his psychologist, the three of us, talked it over, and he was let back out on the compound, and I continued to work with him for years.
Wow. What kind of work did he was he aware of what happened, and could he acknowledge?
After that, he apologized, and he would come into the group saying, I don't know how I could have thought that.
What kind of work did he do? And maybe this leads to a broader question of tell us about some of these projects and some of the work that you did.
Well, he would do paintings and drawings. He worked a lot with tempera paint. Sometimes he would make sort of fragmented black outline of geometric shapes and then paint them all in multiple colors. Sometimes he would use a marker and make tiny little constricted drawings of a figure drawing or something like that. He had his own little set of images that he kind of stuck to over and over.
Well, tell us about you. You brought with you a book, which is The Art of the Federal Medical Center at Butner, North Carolina. And it opens up the first page is The Labyrinth. Tell us about that.
Well, this was a Thanksgiving meditation. So the inmates and I figured out how to paint a labyrinth onto the grass. We used tempera paint so that when the rain came, it washed away, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, because there are a lot of rules in a federal prison, I'm guessing.
Yes.
And painting the
yes.
grass might just, you might run afoul.
That's right.
There's also a chapel here, which was a pretty dreary place until you got there. Tell us about what you found and what you did with it.
Well, the chapel, at the time the hospital opened, was a 20 by 20 foot room painted gray with a low ceiling and no side windows. So I asked the chaplains what we could do, and they were very cautious about putting imagery that would specify a faith group or be in opposition to the rules of a faith group. So I said, the sky is above us all. So our facilities department made a canvas the whole width of the room and 3 feet high. And we put a series of canvases into that frame, and we painted a wide sweeping skyscape 20 feet wide with a cloudy, beautiful sky.
It's a fascinating. It's a beautiful picture, and it spans the entire width of the wall. It's framed. And it is cloudy. It's a beautiful cloudy sky.
Thank you.
But it's cloudy.
Yes.
This is not the bright, sunny, you know, sky of, yeah.
No. The trick to it is this was actually inspired by a liturgical artist named Catherine Kapikian. And her composition that inspired this, you could take out a panel and put in something different according to the liturgical calendar and the colors on the liturgical calendar. Well, we fixed our panels so you could take one out and substitute in a panel for the faith group that was meeting there. So we have a panel for Christian worship, Buddhist worship, and various other faith groups.
And they come and go, so you can take the panel in.
Yes,
and put it
you
out.
Can substitute. It can be just the sky, or it can be feature the image of a faith group.
How did the inmates react to it? I mean, once they saw it up there, and of course this was their work, right? They did
yes,
the painting.
Yes.
Any reaction?
Oh yes, they just gasped when they saw it. I remember one of the inmate artists was painting it, and I had used the word nebulous about the clouds, and he was painting in little circles, swirly clouds, and saying nebulous, nebulous.
And they were actually nebulous clouds, so it's kind of perfect. Well, now tell us about the Mobile Project, because that's also featured in the book. And I should say that we have these some of these pictures on our website now, stateofthings.org, and you can see some of the photos of some of the artwork that Sue Etheridge had done over her 24-year career. But tell us about this Mobile.
Well, the inspiration for the Mobile came in a group that I had in which an inmate said, people just come here to die. And we do have a lot of fatalities. We're an oncology center of excellence.
This was a cancer patient who said that, right? What?
No, it actually wasn't a cancer patient. It was mental health patient who said, people come here to die. And another person in the group who was an orderly working in the oncology department said, that's not true. We have very good success with some cancers. And I said, wait a minute, is that true? And I found out it was true. And I said, then that's the untold story. That's the story we need to call attention to. So I found other stories that are things to be proud of. So we put labels in etchings on the windows in a prominent area above a stairway. And then in order to call attention to the things we're proud of, we made a mobile that is made with circles of silk batik, and it's exquisitely balanced, and it's there to call attention to the title, which is Expand the Definition of a Worthwhile Life, and then call attention to the things we're proud of. But that was a highlight the day we installed that.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, the facilities department sent an inmate up into the crawl space above the big stairwell, and he drilled a pinhole and dropped a line. And then inmates who were in leadership in the Mobile Project assembled the mobile and attached it to that line. So then we did a countdown. And after the countdown, we started the music of Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Oh, the theme from 2001.
Yes.
Yes, perfect.
Yes. And the inmate up in the crawl space started reeling in his line, and the mobile rose to the ceiling as if by magic.
This is a beautiful work of art. I mean, all of these, who made the frames for these circular frames?
Those come as, they come from the art supply catalog. Okay. And they are blank circles of silk, and the inmates, I taught them how to batik paint them, and so it took us a year to make that whole project, but it was so worthwhile. It was really a highlight.
Well, tell us about the images, because some of them seem kind of highly abstract and others are sort of concrete. Tell us about the images.
Okay, we had three component parts. After a while, we could see that the batik paintings fell into categories. So we had a category that was celestial, and it was things like the Big Dipper and Orion and the moon. Actually, the moon is the man in the moon face is the Mona Lisa. We had another category that was organic, and it had plants and animals in the paintings. Then we had another section that was abstract. And so among the abstract paintings, we have a master study of Andy Warhol's Marilyn Monroe. So we got all of that together. And the thing about it is, in a prison, nothing changes from one day to the next. Every time you look at that mobile, it's different. It moves with the wind currents, and it's different every time you see it.
It really is beautiful. It's at our website, stateofthings.org, if you want to take a look. One of Sue Etheridge's works that she worked on with the inmates at the Butner facility in her 24 years there. So tell me about this. You worked on this for a year. Were there any inmates who began this project and didn't survive, who passed away in the process of this?
There were inmates, I'm pretty sure, who didn't survive. But there were inmates who were released. You know, and there were inmates who were still there and probably might still be there.
I mean, it's interesting to think about the conversations you can have about a work of art that began as this kind of where's the hope in what seems to be despair. Mm-hmm. If you lose people along the way, it might generate a few conversations. Did that happen? Did the work then generate conversations among the group?
Oh, sure. That is really the point of doing art therapy. It's the art, it's the beauty, but it's also the internal, the externalization and discussion of what comes up for the artist in the art.
And art therapy was a relatively young profession when you began, right?
Yes. The Art Therapy Association of America, the American Art Therapy Association, was founded in 1967. That is a pretty young profession. Yeah. But the Art Therapy Association of North Carolina was founded in 1995.
95?
Right.
Wow.
So I was a charter member of that.
And how have things changed, or have they?
Well, art therapy in North Carolina is still a pioneer area, and we art therapists spend a lot of time explaining what we do. There is not an art therapy master's program in this state. The closest one is the Eastern Virginia School of Medicine, and there are very strong programs throughout the country, but none in North Carolina, much to my sorrow.
Well, is there a kind of skepticism about this, that you're just giving people the sort of arts and crafts to occupy their time? Are there people who just don't take it seriously?
There are some. There are. It's like religion. I think there are believers and non-believers. I had a psychiatrist say to me once, I had told him that his patient was in my group, and he says, well, that's good. It gives him something to do with his time. And I said, that's like saying standing in the pill line gives him something to do with his time.
Were there any great artists in your group, do you think?
Oh, sometimes, yes, yes. Sometimes there are trained artists who come and go. There are some artists who develop. There are what you would call outsider artists in the group. I love that kind of work.
I'm talking with Sue Etheridge, who does love her work. She worked for 24 years at the Butner Federal Prison. She's now working in the state prison system as an art therapist, and our conversation will continue on the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Sue Etheridge is with me, an art therapist who works with an exceptional population with mentally ill inmates. She spent 24 years working at the medical facility at the federal prison in Butner, and she now works with prisoners in the central prison here in Raleigh. So you had, we talked about the permanent installation, a mural in the chapel, but there's also a paper mural that goes up regularly, or went up. Tell us about that.
Well, we had a project with the mental health patients called the Mural of the Month. And we would make that on paper. It would be 3 feet high and 8 feet wide. And we would do a new one every month. And in fact, a volunteer who had been a nurse, a psychiatric nurse with us, retired and came back as a volunteer. Imagine.
Wow.
Coming back for no money.
In the same place where she had worked.
Right.
So she knew she, what she was getting into, right? Yeah.
Right. And so, and she did a lot of work on the Mural of the Month as well. But it was our tradition that we would put up a new mural every month. And it had a particular place where we would hang it in the institution in a prominent hallway that everyone went past. And so people were eager to see what the new mural would be.
And I understand it was kind of a barometer in terms of how things were going in the institution, right?
Right. It was a really big no-no to bother the mural. It was in harm's way. It was in a vulnerable place. And if the mural would get damaged, someone would immediately come tell me. But it became an indicator for how well things were going on in the unit. Because if things were not right, someone might damage the mural. I was asked by staff and inmates, why don't you put it behind glass? Why don't you put it up high? Why don't you put it out of the way? No. The officers learned that they could observe the behavior of the patients in how they treated the mural and get an indication of how things were going in the hospital.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you, you as a therapist might be able to read this kind of a sign, but the mm-hmm. but the guards were, so the staff mm-hmm. was getting it as well.
Yes, yes. It was. It would be pretty obvious. If the mural was damaged, the first thing I would do, I would fix it. If it got damaged again, I would fix it again. And that would go on and on until it was just not able to be fixed. Now, that was a rare thing. Most of the time, I would tell them, in order to have beauty in your lives, you have to take care of it. And they would take care of it most of the time.
Well, this is an amazing thought, this idea of a sacred space that you can sort of internalize as an inmate. On the other hand, when it's really going badly, mm-hmm. this becomes the expression of how bad it is.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's right.
And it's all made of paper, nothing.
That's right. Wow. It's a piece of paper.
Wow. So, and the staff, you've talked about that. You're there, you know, for 8 or 12 hours a day or however many hours you put in. Then you have to leave. And so this, and I know you've said this, meant that you had to have great confidence in the staff.
That's right. I had confidence in the professionalism of the staff, in that the patients were being left in good hands. We never close. In a prison, we never close. So if the patient's needs were taken care of around the clock.
Or we never open, depending on which side of the gate you're on.
That's right.
Yeah. So this means when there's a literal changing of the guard, you had a new captain come in, and I know that caused you some anxiety, but tell us the story, how it turned out.
Well, we got a new captain, and he's the administrator over all the correctional officers. And I was a little concerned about how he might regard me and my work. So I met him in the hallway and introduced myself as the art therapist. And he said, "You've got to meet my mother." And that was the most unexpected thing that I had run into. So eventually I did meet his mother. And she was a patron in a major art exhibit called The Missing Piece, Artists and the Dalai Lama. And it was 80 contemporary artists whose works were in major museums everywhere, who had done an art piece in tribute to the peacemaking efforts of the Dalai Lama. And so I did meet his mother, and she invited me to do a presentation about art therapy work to the leadership and curators of the Missing Piece Project.
That brought you to California, right?
Yes, yes. That was in Palo Alto. And they said, "We would love to exhibit in a prison." So I invited them to come to my prison.
Yeah, I was trying to think, where could they exhibit?
Really? So they provided me with very high-quality, beautiful reproduction posters of many of the works of art in the Missing Piece Project. So we had an exhibit in the visiting room at the medical center. And then we had it again at another one of the facilities at Butner. The inmates thought they were in the museum for a day. It was so heartwarming. They spent the day. Some of them read every explanation about the paintings. We had explanations about the paintings and about the artists, and the inmates were really involved in that. They could watch a slideshow of the entire exhibit. We had a reading table with art books, and we had a room for self-expression. People could do writings, they could do artwork, and we had a big mural paper on the wall, so they did a mural about peace.
Wow, and how long was the exhibit up?
Well, it was just up for a couple of days, but it was a thrill. It was a thrill to get the inmates exposed to that. And the day afterwards, an entourage from California came to Butner, and they presented our warden with a Compassion in Action Award from the Dalai Lama Foundation.
Wow.
So that was truly a highlight.
I don't know if we have any of the photos of the pictures from this exhibit. I know we have a bunch of pictures from your work at our website, stateofthings.org, and we may or may not have one from that exhibit. But it's stunning work. It was there for a week, and as you said, it got quite a bit of attention. You then came to the attention of the Dalai Lama.
Yes. After we had the Missing Piece Project at Butner, an inmate photographer had taken photos of the exhibit and the attendance at the exhibit. So I had to edit out all the faces and compile a book of photos of the Missing Piece at Butner. And I sent that to the curators of the Missing Piece Project, who presented a copy of that to His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, India. And I'm told that he paged through the entire book. So it was very heartwarming, and that's how he knew about the work.
And you won the Dalai Lama's Unsung Hero of Compassion, or for compassion.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
What was that like?
It was amazing. Now, I don't like that word. It's overused. Mm-hmm. I try not to use it, but I can't come up with anything better. I have worked behind closed doors for all these years, and for the work to become known is so out of the ordinary for me. It's unbelievable in the sense of not being able to believe it.
Well, if you had to draw it, what would it look like?
Oh, my gosh. It would just be splashy, colorful, wonderful.
You got to meet the Dalai Lama?
I did.
What did you say to him?
Well, when we had the Missing Piece Project and we presented him with the book, I asked the inmates, what message would you like to give them? And they said, think of us. And so when I met the Dalai Lama, I said, thank you for thinking of people in prison.
Did he answer you?
Yes, he did. He just acknowledged that he thinks of them.
Did he say? Did you have a chance to have a conversation with him?
The Unsung Heroes event. There were 50 honorees, and so it was like graduation.
Wow.
You walk across the stage, and His Holiness acknowledges you, and so that's how it was. So no, I didn't have a long conversation, but I did get to thank him, and I'm so pleased to have gotten to do that.
What do you make of this? If you have one wish, one thing to say to the Dalai Lama, you say, think of us, hold us in your mind. And I then think about your work, the idea of bringing a group together, of coming up with a theme by consensus. I mean, the idea that thoughts, things in a mind that is well-intended, has an intention, can bring a group together. I mean, this is some pretty powerful stuff. Have you thought about that?
It's power. It's powerful. I can't do a lot about the justice system, but I can do that. I do what I can, and what I can do is give these inmates art materials and free expression of what's in their thoughts at the time. And it may not seem like a lot. To me, it's a lot.
It's 100% of what you can do, and that is a lot. But think about, so I hate to pull you out of your bliss, because you've made the excellent point that you're going to go in there, whatever this prison system might be doing, and do the best you can for the people who are there. But when you think about the prison system and all of the people you've met and all of that sort of latent talent, I mean, what do you think?
Well, it's complicated and it's conflictual in me. The fact that we have to lock people up, there's tragedy involved. There's tragedy involved in a lot of their stories. There's not a boring case in the file, I assure you. And I have great compassion for their situation. I feel like it's my duty and responsibility to work in the system to make their lives as good as they can be under their circumstances. I don't feel like I can change the world. I can change my corner of the world.
Well, then it sounds like you're doing it and making it much brighter and much prettier at the very least, not to mention what it does for the hearts and souls of people who do the work. But you're not the only one in your family to become involved in the criminal justice system. You have an uncle in Colorado.
Yes, my late uncle in Colorado. He was the first public defender in the country. In the 60s in Colorado, he set up a pilot program for a public defender service for state inmates in Colorado. And he worked his whole life in opposition to the death penalty. And I guess that's in my in my blood and bones as well.
He had quite a practice when someone was sentenced to death. Tell us about that.
Whenever there was an execution in Colorado, he would call a press conference and he would very vocally renounce his Colorado citizenship and leave the state. He would not be present for an execution in the state.
How do you feel about the death penalty?
Well, I have grown up lifelong believing that there is wrong about it, and it's obvious that there are injustices around it. I don't know. I'm glad I don't have to decide, because I don't know that people can forfeit their place on earth, but maybe they can. It happens, but I can't support it openly.
You are now working with the state of North Carolina. You're not working with the federal prison anymore. Tell us about that job. What are you doing?
Well, in that job, I'm working with the psychiatric patients. And one of the things we're doing there, I'm a newcomer there. I'm still learning what the security requirements are and other requirements of the job. But we're working to set up in their new hospital what they call a treatment mall. And that's a very exciting thing, that the patients will be able to come to a centralized location for their therapies and have a lot more movement off their units and freedom of choice of what to do and what's available. We're excited about the possibilities. It's right now in the beginning stages, but we're working on it.
And so that all of the sort of the clinical professionals who are involved in the care would then meet as a team, which I guess is not happening or had not been happening.
Well,
until
it does happen. Mm-hmm. It does happen. And there are treatment teams meeting. But there are a few places where the inmates can be brought off their unit for their treatment. But as a rule, they stay on their housing unit. But with the treatment mall, we're wanting to get them off their housing unit and into this other treatment milieu.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck in all of that, and what a pleasure talking with you, Sue Etheridge. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you.
Sue Etheridge is an art therapist who works with mentally ill inmates in Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you for listening to our show. We've got some photos that some of which we described on the program. Stateofthings.org is the place to go if you want to see them. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.